Well, it is very nice to see everybody here this morning. I do know that we have a few visitors with us, and I encourage you to fill out a visitor's card at this time if you have not done so already. There will be a time at the end of our worship service where some individuals will go around with some baskets. If you filled out the visitor's card, that'll be a good time for you to place it in that basket. We just want to have a record of your attendance so that we can contact you and thank you for your attendance today and ask you if you have any spiritual needs. As always, we'd love to sit down and have a Bible study with you and present to you in that context the gospel, which is simply the good news that the Son of Man came to this world to bring salvation to us all. Let's talk about this phrase, the Son of Man. It is a phrase that's used repeatedly in the Bible, and it makes us wonder why. Why of all the things that Jesus could have called himself and all the things that he did sometimes call himself, why does he use the phrase the Son of Man most often to describe himself? In the book of Matthew, he uses the phrase Son of Man 32 times, in Mark 15 times, in Luke 26 times, and in the Gospel of John 12 times. In total, in the Gospels, Jesus calls himself the Son of Man 85 times. It's noteworthy also that in the Gospels, nobody calls him the Son of Man but him. It is not a phrase that anybody else uses except in disregard of him. Perhaps you've wondered the same thing then, of why does he use the phrase the Son of Man so frequently? And why is it that in some cases he seems to shy away from the terms like the Christ or the Son of God? We know from Mark chapter 1 that he discouraged those from using that term in Matthew chapter 16 verse 20 and in John 10 and verse 24 as well. He is downright hesitant to call himself the Son of God or the Christ. Hesitant to hear others use that term of him as well. Son of Man is used in many different contexts. Sometimes Jesus is describing the Son of Man as one who has great divine authority. In Matthew chapter 9 and verse 6, for example, and in Mark 2 and verse 10, he says that the Son of Man has authority to forgive sins. We studied that in our Bible classes this morning. The strange thing is, though, that while the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath in Matthew 12 and verse 8, the Son of Man is also described as one who has all of the infirmities and weaknesses physically of a human being. You have several scriptures up here, Matthew 17 verse 9 and verses 12 and 22, where he describes very, very distinctly that the Son of Man is going to be killed, before which he will suffer at the hands of his enemies. Those are very human things. In Luke 7 and verse 34, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. So maybe that's one of the reasons why we find the term a little bit confusing or perplexing, is because on the one hand, the Son of Man seems to have the authority of God to forgive sins and to command the Sabbath. But on the other hand, the Son of Man is just as weak as we are. He gets hungry and thirsty. He can be killed even. So again, why does Jesus use the term Son of Man so much? Why does he warn others to be careful about using other terms like the Christ or the Son of God? Well, maybe what we need to do is establish in our minds just what the phrase Son of Man means in other contexts. Let's start in the Old Testament. The phrase Son of Man is used throughout the Old Testament to simply refer to humanity. There's other phrases like sons of Israel or sons of Ammon or sons of Amalek. That's simply a term that the Hebrews used to describe humans, the descendants of other people. Son of Man is simply a son of man, a human being. As a representative example, consider in Psalm 8 and verse 4, where it says, "What is man that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him?" Understand, of course, in Hebrew poetry, the Hebrews in their poetry would use this idea of parallelisms, where they would use two different phrases to describe the same thing. And this is an example of that Hebrew poetic parallelism, What is man that thou dost take thought of him, and the son of man that thou dost care for him? Man and son of man are parallel to each other. Different phrases being used to describe the same thing. So what the writer of Psalm 8 verse 4 is saying is that son of man is simply a man, a human being. So that's one way that son of man is used in the Old Testament to simply describe human beings. But I don't think that's what Jesus necessarily means when he calls himself the son of man. Because other people would probably use the term also. How come Jesus is the only one who uses that term in the Gospels if it just means human? Well, there were other uses, such as in the prophets. In the book of Ezekiel, for example, you'll find Ezekiel called a son of man many, many times. I give you a few representative examples, although you could go hardly a page in the book of Ezekiel without God calling Ezekiel a son of man. Chapter 2, verse 1, verse 3, verse 6, verse 8. Chapter 3, verse 1, verse 3, verse 4, verse 10, etc., etc. In Daniel chapter 8 and verse 17, Daniel is also called a son of man. So the term son of man then also has the idea of prophecy attached to it. Still though, I don't think that Jesus uses the term the Son of Man to simply call himself a prophet. It has that idea attached to it, but I don't think that's the only thing that Jesus is trying to get across. Obviously, he's a Son of Man in terms of he's a human. Obviously, he's a Son of Man in terms of he's a prophet. But is there another way that Son of Man is used that Jesus is trying to get his listeners and today his readers to think about? Let's go to Daniel chapter 7. And I know it was read earlier in our worship service, but I would like to read a few verses out of Daniel chapter 7. In particular, we'll notice verse 13, but I'm going to start all the way back in verse 9 for context. Daniel chapter 7. And verse 9. Follow along with me if you will. I kept looking until the thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. Who's the Ancient of Days there? The Ancient of Days is God. That is God that he sees. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending to him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books, he says, the books were open. Verse 11, then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of it, of their life, was granted to them for an appointed period of time. Understand, within this vision, he had seen these four beasts, and these beasts represent kingdoms of men that were going to come. And in the time of that fourth beast, this is what we're talking about now. In the time of that fourth beast, this is when Daniel sees the vision. Verse 13. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, keep that in mind, by the way, log that little phrase away, with the clouds of heaven, that's going to come into play later on. With the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. By the first century, the phrase Son of Man had come to mean the Messiah. It was a loaded phrase, pregnant with meaning to them. It was not just that somebody was a human being. It was not just that somebody was a prophet. The Son of Man was the Christ. The Son of Man was the Messiah, who would return glory to David's throne and bring prosperity, long awaited for, back to the kingdom of Israel. It was a loaded phrase, and it must have stood out every single time Jesus used it. As I already said, nobody ever called Jesus the Son of Man except to quote him. There are two cases where they're quoting what Jesus had said of himself. Nobody calls him the Son of Man. Nobody uses the term Son of Man just in their regular speech. You don't find that in the Gospels. People don't just say, oh, hey, Son of Man, I was thinking the other day. This was a buzzword to them. You know what a buzzword is, right? A buzzword is, it's one of those words that every time somebody uses it, it conjures up ideas. It's loaded with meaning. The Son of Man was a buzzword to these people. They were expecting the Son of Man to come back. What I love about Jesus is he uses the term Son of Man 85 times, as I already said, 85 times in the prophets. And it must have stuck out every single time he said it. It must have been one of those words that made a lot of people very uncomfortable. And yet he pushes it and pushes it and pushes it and repeatedly calls himself the Son of Man. And he does so not just as a description, but also in prophetic terms. That's an important point to bring out. For anybody who thinks that Jesus is just calling himself just a man, I'm a son of man, I'm a human being, he uses the term Son of Man in Matthew chapter 24 several times. We know that Matthew chapter 24 is describing the destruction of Jerusalem. And repeatedly in 27, in verse 30, in verse 37, he says, the Son of Man. Not only that, but when you see the sign of the Son of Man coming on the clouds. There's that phrase again, coming on the clouds. We read that in Daniel chapter 17, didn't we? One like a Son of Man coming on the clouds. Jesus is specifically saying in Matthew chapter 24... that the Son of Man that you read about in Daniel 7, the Son of Man that you've been reading about for over 400 years now, the Son of Man that you've been waiting for, that you've been expecting, that will bring prosperity back to Israel, that same Son of Man who came on the clouds, he's going to be coming on the clouds here. And it's not going to be pleasant. The Son of Man will come on the clouds and his sign shall appear in the sky, and that will be the sign of the destruction of Jerusalem. There are, of course, other passages here that you can consider. Please write these down and study these on your own time. We don't have time to look at these in incredible detail. There is one passage I want to spend a little extra time on, though. Please go to Matthew chapter 26. As Jesus is preparing himself for what he knows is going to happen, for the death that he knew would happen, Luke chapter 9 makes that very clear. He uses the phrase Son of Man here in the company of his enemies, and it's very striking the way he puts it. Please notice in Matthew chapter 26, and let's speak up here in verse 62. The high priest stood up and said to him, "Do you make no answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." Now they understood that the Christ was the Son of God. They knew that when the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of Man was going to come, he was going to be, would always have been, and always will be, the Son of God. And look at Jesus' answer in verse 64. "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." There he is quoting Daniel chapter 7. Of himself. Unequivocally. No excuses. No beating around the bush. Jesus says, "You read it. You said it. You got it." Go to Luke chapter 22 now and notice Luke's account here. We get a little bit different language here. I like the way Luke puts it. Luke chapter 22, beginning in verse, we'll start kind of in the same context in verse 66. Luke 22 and verse 66. "Now when it was day, the council of the elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber, saying, 'If you are the Christ, tell us.' But he said to them, 'If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask a question, you will not answer.'" The time for conversation was over, is basically what he's saying. The time for death is now. Jesus knew what was going on. He was in complete control. He wasn't startled when those soldiers showed up in the garden. He wasn't surprised when Judas kissed him. It didn't catch him off guard when they led him away to the skull to crucify him. But he says in verse 69, "From now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." Again, quoting Daniel. And they all said, "Are you the Son of God?" And he said to them, "Yes, I am. Yes, I am." The Son of God is the Son of Man. Daniel 7 came true in Jesus. And Jesus let them know that. He uses the term Son of Man to bring their minds back to that prophecy, to remind them of the truth that they had always known, but were choosing to ignore at this time. And I like the way Jesus puts that. He says, if I just tell you, you won't believe me. And if I ask you a question, you're not going to answer. Because he does answer them, doesn't he? He says, tell us plainly, are you the Christ? And he says, I am. And they didn't believe him. Just like he said. Just like he predicted. Just like he told them. If I told you, you would not believe me. In the very next verse, at the end of that chapter in Luke, what further need do we have? The man is a blasphemer. The man is a lunatic. Take him away and kill him. This still leaves us a little bit wondering why. Why use the term Son of Man so frequently? Why use the term Son of Man so stubbornly, knowing what it meant to his listeners, knowing what that phrase would conjure up in their hearts and their minds, knowing that that would be the very phrase that they would use against him to send him to Rome, to Pilate, to be killed? Why? Going back to Daniel's prophecy, isn't it interesting that when Daniel sees this great throne room scene of the Ancient of Days and the glory, the myriads of myriads and the thousands of thousands serving before the Ancient of Days, isn't it interesting that when this one comes and stands before the Ancient of Days, he doesn't see one like a Son of God. He doesn't see one like the Word. He sees one like a Son of Man. What is that supposed to tell you? What is that supposed to mean? That there is one like a Son of Man, not one like a Son of God. Now, this doesn't mean that the Christ was not fully God. This doesn't mean that he wasn't the Son of God. But doesn't that say something that when Daniel sees in the prophecy one like a Son of Man, doesn't that say something? Of course, we all know and we affirm we're all Christians, of course. If we have been baptized in the body of Jesus Christ, we've been baptized into his body. If we believe that he is, of course we believe he's the Son of God. There's no denying that. And the New Testament affirms that. Colossians 2 verse 9 very clearly says that he is the fullness of deity in bodily form. As in, he is everything it means to be God in the form of everything it means to be a human body. He wasn't one or the other. He was both. The fullness of deity in bodily form. And those who deny that he was that are the Antichrist. The one who denies the Son cannot have the Father also in 1 John chapter 2, verses 22 and 23. But Jesus intentionally emphasized this Son of Man phrase. He intentionally emphasized his human side, especially his very real and very painful death. We'll look at Luke 9 here in just a moment. Let's actually turn to the book of Luke, and let's notice Luke chapter 9. Actually serves as a pretty good segue into our next point. Have your Bibles open to Luke chapter 9, and let's begin reading in verse 18, if you'd like to follow along in Luke chapter 9 and verse 18. And it came about that while he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he questioned them, saying, "Who do the multitudes say that I am?" Now they answered and said, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen again." And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered, "The Christ of God." Now he warned them in verse 21 and instructed them not to tell anyone this, saying, "The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day." Isn't it interesting? And the point I want to bring out from Luke chapter 9 is this. That in the very moment that Peter, and I think the other apostles as well were along the same lines, but Peter, in the very moment that Peter affirms that Jesus is the Son of God, the Christ of God, Jesus responds with the phrase, "the Son of Man." "You are the Christ of God." And Jesus says, "Yes, and the Son of Man must suffer many things." You see what Jesus did there. And what's the very next story in the Gospel of Luke? What do you read about beginning in verse 28? What's the next event that happens in Luke's account of the Gospel? Peter says, "You are the Son of God." And Jesus responds with, "Yes, the Son of Man must suffer." And in the very next story, you have the transfiguration. And in verse 35, the voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my Son, my chosen one." It certainly seems like the terms are interchangeable, aren't they? The Son of Man is the Son of God. The Son of God is the Son of Man. There is no argument. There is no conflict there. The fullness of deity dwelling in bodily form. That boggles our minds, doesn't it? That boggles our minds. If you want an analogy, it's a little bit silly, I admit, but if you want an analogy to kind of consider how strange it is to think about the fullness of deity dwelling in bodily form. For anybody who's got kids, take your 5-year-old son's shirt and try to put it on. Just try to put it on. Just take your son's shirt. Take a pair of your toddler's pants and try to put them on. You got a little fat guy and a little coat going on, right? That's silly. I get it. I understand. That's a silly analogy. Try to imagine what it would be like to take the fullness of deity, everything that it means to be God, and stuff that into a human body. Yet there is no conflict between those two things. The fullness of God dwelling in bodily form. So while he is fully God, he is also fully human. And Jesus repeatedly affirms that in his constant, stubborn use of the phrase "Son of Man." He experienced life as we experience it. He suffers as we suffer. He hurt. He hungered. He grieved. Hebrews 2 makes this very clear. Let's read a few verses out of Hebrews 2 as we begin to draw our lesson to a close. In Hebrews chapter 2, beginning in verse 6, notice as he quotes Psalm 8, "One has testified somewhere saying, 'What is man that thou rememberest him? Or the son of man that thou art concerned about him? Thou hast made him for a little while lower than the angels. Thou hast crowned him with glory and honor and hast appointed him over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things in subjection under his feet. For in subjecting all things to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. But now we do not yet see all things subjected to him. But we do see him," and a lot of your Bibles have capitalized the letter H in that "him." "But we do see him who has been made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone." Now, deity cannot die, right? God as God cannot taste death. God as God is not physical. He's not mortal. He cannot die. Jesus had to be made like us in appearance. He had to be the fullness of God dwelling in bodily form to taste death that we might not die spiritually. "For it was fitting for him," it says in verse 10, "for whom are all things fitting and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory to perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are all from one Father, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren." You know why Jesus can call us brethren? Because he breathed the same air that we breathed. Because he drank from the same well. Because he ate the same food. Because he stubbed his toe and got bit by mosquitoes. Because he hungered. Because he hurt. Because he was tempted by Satan. He calls us brethren because we're his brothers and sisters in the flesh. Go on down to verse 17. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren. Notice, he had to be. Jesus said that, remember in Luke chapter 9, what we already read, Jesus made it very clear that the Son of Man must suffer. He must, not he should, or could, or would, or maybe, he must suffer. If we're going to be saved, he had to suffer. He had to be made like his brethren in all things, that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. Notice that if Jesus had not come in the flesh, if Jesus had not been made like us in appearance as a man, if he had not suffered, if he had not been betrayed, if he had not been beaten by those Roman soldiers, if he had not been killed, and by his own power, if he had not been raised from the dead, you and I would be so lost, so hopelessly, miserably, woefully lost. Jesus had to die. He had to be sacrificed. It took, as one person once said, the great condescension of the Son of God to raise up man to salvation. Notice in Romans chapter 8, I think a passage that sums up what we're saying. In Romans chapter 8, beginning in verse 1, there is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has set you free from the law of sin and of death. For what that law could not do, weak as it was through the flesh, God did, sending His own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh. Now that's not saying that the flesh is inherently sinful. And it's not saying that Jesus was inherently sinful by taking on the likeness of sinful flesh. Simply saying that man's tendency has always been from the beginning to be sinful. Yet Jesus took on the appearance of sinful flesh. Remember in Hebrews 2, though, it says that he was tempted and did not fall. Hebrews chapter 4 says the same thing. Tempted yet did not sin. He took on that likeness. And as an offering for sin, he condemned sin in the flesh in order that the requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. Let's end our lesson with this question. Is he still the Son of Man? Is he still the Son of Man? Now, I know that none of us would quibble with the idea that while he was in the flesh during his earthly ministry, he was the Son of Man at that point, because that phrase, again, emphasizes his humanity. He was a Son of Man. Daniel very clearly saw him come as a Son of Man, not as a Son of God, not as a powerful spiritual being, but as a human. And he obviously died as a Son of Man. He was raised up as a Son of Man. And when the apostles saw him leave on the cloud in Acts chapter 1 to ascend to glory with his Father, he was a Son of Man during that ascension. Is he still the Son of Man? What's interesting is that when Stephen, in Acts chapter 7 and verse 56, when Stephen is confronting the enemies of the cross, he sees a vision of Jesus Christ. The heavens open, and who does he see there in Acts chapter 7 and verse 56? But the Son of Man. The Son of Man sitting in glory next to the Father. Even now, Jesus is the Son of Man. Now, he's not the Son of Man as in fleshly being. He's not the Son of Man in the sense that he is a human right now. I would say that Jesus is the Son of Man in the sense that as He was raised from the dead as a forerunner, as the first fruits of the resurrection, so we too shall be raised from the dead in His likeness. He is as human, now, as we will be in the resurrection. Now, we don't know what that's going to look like right now. In 1 John chapter 3, John says, we don't know as yet what that will be, but in the resurrection, we will be like Him, in His glory, raised anew. As He lives as a resurrected being, we too shall live as resurrected beings with Him. He is now the Son of Man. Not a Son of Man in the flesh any longer, but the Son of Man, as in the first fruits of the resurrection, He is the first human being to be raised from the dead, to be in glory with the Father. And we'll be like Him in that glory as well. Let's end our lesson this morning with a passage from 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I want to notice what the Apostle Paul has to say here about this same subject. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, beginning in verse 35. But someone will say, how are the dead raised? And with what kind of body do they come? You fool! That which you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And that which you sow, you do not sow the body which is to be, but a bare grain, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body just as He wished, and to each of the seeds a body of its own. All flesh is not the same flesh, but there are flesh of men, and there's another flesh of beasts, another flesh of birds, and another of fish. There are also heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. But the glory of the heavenly is one, and the glory of the earthly is another. There is one glory of the sun, and another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for stars differ from star in glory. So also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown a perishable body. It is raised an imperishable body. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. So also it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living soul. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. The Son of God came in the form of flesh. He condescended. He humbled Himself. He lived as a human being. And He died as a human being and was raised in the same way that we will be raised on the last day. He had to go through that. If He didn't, we would all be condemned. But He did. And that is the good news of the gospel. He lives in glory now, and He beckons to you from the right hand of the Father to live in glory with Him. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.